Good evening. Thank you for that. If you want to be turning in your lesson books to lesson number 8, that's where we're going to be picking up this evening as we continue in Jesus' discussion of the parables. And this one, again, comes as a slightly different one, kind of follows on the heels of a particular teaching of his, and then he tells a couple stories to support that teaching or to go along with that teaching. Don't know of any additional announcements to make. I did get a report from Daniel this afternoon regarding the triplets. They are all continuing to improve. Lydia is probably doing the best, and hopefully they'll come home. She didn't come home today, but should come home very quickly. She's totally eating on her own, sleeping on her own, getting very tiny bits of oxygen support at night, and that's it. Oliver and Amos, Amos being the one that's struggling the most, he's the little one, but is making progress. When the doctor came in today, he said he thought he saw a really good improvement. They've removed his IV, and he's getting all his nutrition, not from mouth feeding, but through a tube, through his nose. But it's all, they want to make sure they're giving him all his nutrition in his stomach so that he continues to feel that fullness of stomach as well, not just the supplements through the IV. But he's making improvements, and Daniel said Oliver's doing nothing but eating, sleeping, and continuing to gain weight. So he is on oxygen still until they can get the congestion cleared up, but it doesn't seem to be having a great effect on him, even though they are in the hospital. So we do appreciate the prayers. Right now the intent is that Judy will be leaving tomorrow evening and be gone for probably about the next 10 or 11 days, something like that, coming back just in time for our next couples class. So she'll be gone almost 2 weeks, but then back in time for us for our next couples class, which is on the 27th, 2 weeks from today. Any other announcements we need to make before we begin? If not, I'm going to ask Hal if he would lead us in a word of prayer. Amen. All right, we want to be turning in your Bibles to Luke chapter 14. That's where we will begin. Before we do that, I'm going to read you one of the parables that one of the high schoolers wrote, and then we'll get into Luke chapter 14 and to read that. Once there was a paralyzed man in a wheelchair rolling along the sidewalk to get food. The paralyzed man needed help trying to get in the door. That's when two men walked up. They completely ignored the paralyzed man that needed help. Later on, the two men were heading home, got in a head-on collision. One man died on the impact, and the other was paralyzed from the waist down. When the newly paralyzed man was heading to therapy at the hospital one day, he saw the same guy he ignored previously. The man had realized what he had done and apologized, and the two paralyzed men had a long conversation about life. That's a good parable for a high school student. One of the younger kids in there wrote that. That's a very, very good, very interesting parable. And I'll read the others as we continue in some of the other classes as well. In Luke chapter 14, we had just finished up a portion of Luke chapter 14 when we were looking at the last parables, as we looked at the parable of the wedding feast in particular. And then moves on once you get into about verse 25, after the wedding feast and the great banquet, then starting in verse 25, we read, "Now great crowds accompanied him, and he turned and said to them," and to me this is interesting if you look at the way this whole conversation comes about, because that's not an unusual thing for large crowds to be around Jesus. They didn't always stay there, but there were many times that there were crowds that were gathering around him to a great extent. When we did one of the Wednesday evenings on A Moment with the Savior, you'll remember that he had come back into town, and the one where we talked about the four friends who took their paralyzed friend and was on the mat and lowered him down through the roof, the whole picture was that you had this this huge crowd of people that were there. And typically, when there were a crowd of people around Jesus, who would you say they were composed of? What, the poor?
Everyday people.
Yeah, everyday people. I'm sorry, what?
They were hungry.
There were those that were hungry.
Curious.
There were some that were just curious. I'm sorry, I heard something else.
I just said those were sick.
Those what? Those who were sick too. They flocked to Jesus, those who were sick, because of the healings that he had done. Sometimes those that were spying on him. It'd be hard to imagine that you had a large group that didn't have a large number of different types of people with different reasons for being there. Wouldn't you agree with that? And Jesus occasionally even said to some, didn't he? Didn't he on one occasion say, the only reason you're even here is what? Yeah, because you're hungry. You got food before and you saw me feed somebody, and the only reason you're following me is for the food. There were people that were that way, no different than the mentality today. There may be a lot of curiosity that isn't necessarily always fulfilled in those that are true seekers. And so it says, a great crowd accompanied him, and he turned and said to them, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother, and wife, and children, and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not bear his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. For which of you, desiring to build a tower, does not first sit down and count the cost, whether he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he's laid the foundation and is not able to finish, all who see it begin to mock him, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. Or what king going out to encounter another king in war will not sit down first and deliberate whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? And if not, while the other is yet a great way off, he sends a delegation and asks for terms of peace. So therefore, any one of you who does not renounce all that he has cannot be my disciple. And then we'll pick up on that last couple verses at the end. So he's going to start this thing out with some incredibly tough statements, is he not? I mean, Jesus, it's interesting that just this morning, as Ken was talking and talked about in the class, this picture sometimes that people have of this God of incredible wrath and severity in the Old Testament, and then this God of love and patience and tolerance in the New Testament, they miss the point that he was the same God then and the same God now. All the love and patience that he has now, he had then. All the severity and wrath that he had then, he has now. He hasn't changed who he is at all. And so Jesus is going to make some incredibly tough statements. There are some things that Jesus says and some things that Jesus requires of us that are not as difficult as others. Would you agree with that? Give me something he asks of you that's not difficult.
To read your Bible.
All right, so is it...
That's not difficult.
Not difficult to think in terms of some multiple of the things that I do in obedience to God. And what makes those things not difficult? Do you ever think of that? Because for some... there's great difficulty in coming to assemble with Christians. Would you agree with that? Some find that to be a very difficult thing. Some find that to be a very easy thing. Yeah, John?
Anytime whatever you require of you that aligns with the way you think, it's easy.
Oh, yeah, then it's always easy. It's interesting because very easy to do what we agree with, because what you agree with does not require what? You ever think about that? Doesn't require changing your mind. Doesn't require what, Mark? Somebody else said something. Doesn't require sacrifice. Not the same kind of sacrifice. Go ahead.
Huh? I was going to say, it's not real obedience if you're just doing it because you're done. It is a step, but
it's a step. Yeah, really not. If it's agreement, it's not necessarily true obedience. I haven't yielded my will to his will, have I? I've just done what I wanted to do. I just happened to be in agreement. Sometimes you'll talk to people. I've counseled with couples over the years, and you find out a lot of times there are people who are seeking confirmation, not advice or counsel. There's a big difference between those two. Sometimes they don't want to change what they're doing. They're looking for somebody to support them in what they're doing. It's kind of like the idea of Rehoboam, isn't it? Rehoboam went and asked for advice. He got advice, and he thought, man, don't like that advice. I'm going to find somebody that gives me the advice that I'm looking for, and that's what he got and splits a kingdom over. So he gives us these very tough things. The easy things that we do are easy because we have yielded ourselves to God first. Wouldn't that be right? In other words, anything so that when he gives me the tough things or gives me anything to do, the tough thing is yielding my will. That's the tough thing in anything that he asks me to do that's difficult. It's because I have some difficulty sometimes yielding my own will and submitting. And so he's going to say to them, here's what we're going to start with. I mean, imagine that you're one of the ones following Jesus. All right, so here's this big group following Jesus. And imagine, you know, you're up pretty close to the front. You want to hear what this guy has to say. And he turns around. The first thing he says to you is, anybody who doesn't hate his father, hate his mother, hate his brothers and sisters, hate his spouse, and even his own life, cannot be my disciple. So how do you feel when he says that? What goes through your mind? What goes through, your thinking process as Jesus is telling you this? And why would he say what he said? Hate your parents? The word that he uses here is not as if he's saying, you know what, you just need to be kind of ambivalent toward them. This is literally the word that would have us consider despising someone. So obviously he has a context in which he means this. Yes, Linda? What's that? All right, and so there's going to be a forsaking in that sense, a turning and going a different direction. Wait, let me see. I saw a couple. Yeah, go ahead, Laura, and then I'll go to Ken.
He didn't mean not to love them or to hate them. He meant, you know, if our parents have a different way to follow Jesus or to think about Jesus, you know, just like in my case, you know, I live with a man that is not Christian, but I follow Jesus no matter what. You know, I want to leave him. I mean, at home, of course, I still love him, but it doesn't mean that I hate him or anything like that. He has his own things, you know, his own thoughts. You know, it's him, but it's not me. You know, I love Jesus. I follow Jesus. You know, and my kids, for instance, some of them go to another church, and you know, it's okay. You know, it's okay for them. Yes, I pray that they find the right path, you know, which is to follow Jesus like I do. But I respect them, you know. I don't mean that I hate them. I love them. I still love them.
And so why does he even say this? Go ahead, Ken, and then I'll go back to Martha after that. Yeah, I mean, there's nothing about the statement that would make you feel like, I really like this guy's teaching. This, you know, there's something about this that just draws me into him. Let's go to Martha and then to Hal. Yeah, no question. This passage could easily be misused. And we'll look at some other thoughts because he tells us other things regarding the same group of people that don't say the same thing. And I mean, he tells me responsibilities I have to my wife, to my parents. The same God that is saying here, hate your parents, tells me that I am to honor my mother and father. And even as we mentioned this morning, there's a side of that I've got to understand. There has to be a balance in here. Huh? Which I think is a great point, because I think that Jesus says things sometimes for the shock that it is intended to have. He intends this to hit them in the face, this statement. You've got to hate your father. You've got to hate your mother. There's no way you walk away thinking, I wonder what he really feels. You know, I wonder what. I mean, he's going to say, let me blast you with the statement, and then you can make a determination as to whether or not you want to find out more about what that means. And I think he's going to help them to understand as to what that means in a second. Let me go to Perry and then back to Nita. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he tells us to honor our prayer, and it is. I think it is hyperbole for a purpose that he wants to get us to understand, or that slap in the face. He's not saying you should disdain them. He's not saying you should disrespect them, but he is going to be talking about some positional effect. Yeah, Anita? And that's what he says in other places as well, is it not? He's going to make the point that you've got to make some choices. Because there is no question in my life that prior to coming to Christ, that there were others, including myself, that sat on the throne of my life. I would say that's probably true of everybody prior to coming to Christ. Whether they're whoever it was, but there's somebody that was there. And I think he is going to help me understand, you've got to make an eternal choice here, a choice that says, I'm going to eliminate all others from that position of priority. Ken and then Mark. Yeah, no question. And if it turns out, like, if we had more information as far as narrative exactly what happened after all of this, you'd probably find out it happened the way that it did in John 6. There were some in John 6 that he said tough things, and it said some turned away. They walked away. When the tough things come out, some are not going to keep following. That probably happened here and happened most times around Jesus. But he is talking about these incredible priority choices you have to make. Mark? Yeah, absolutely, because the very next thing he says is what? He says, if you're not willing to what? He said, if you're not willing to carry your own cross. What does that mean? He said, because if you're not willing to carry your own cross, you can't follow me. What would they have thought of when he said that? Yeah, they certainly got the picture of the cross, didn't they, and understood what that would have meant and would have understood the nature of that and what that was a reference to. The same as when Jesus talked about being lifted up and things of that nature. There were references that they clearly would have understood. And he's saying, how far are you willing to go? How far are you willing to go? What are you willing to do? What are you willing to give up in this case? And so then he tells them a parable. He says, let me put it to you this way. And so the story he tells them is what? He says, there are consequences. And the first story he tells them is about what? A builder who's building a tower. And he says, the builder's going to do what? He's going to, before any consequences, he's going to consider, isn't he? He's going to sit down. Is that not the way it works? Talk to the elders here about the auditorium that is intending to be built. You don't just say, hey, you know what? Let's call the builder, tell him start building out there. Somebody's got to sit down and figure out whether or not you're going to be able to pay what you're building. There'd be nothing worse or more embarrassing than to build a half a building out there, get a foundation laid and a few walls up, and then it stays that way. Anybody ever seen a project that way? Oh, yeah. During several of the booms in Florida, there were a lot of places where apartments went, boom, halfway up. And the whole project stopped. Or a commercial building went, boom, halfway up, and the whole project stopped. And everybody thought the same thing. You know, what? And I'm saying that as we would drive by, you're thinking, what kind of person wouldn't have thought about that ahead of time? Whether they had enough money to complete that project or not. They got ahead of themselves. And he's saying, if you're going to build a project, You're going to sit down, you're going to take the spreadsheets and everything else, and you're going to figure out exactly what this is going to cost. Because he says to the builder, the consequences are what? You don't get it built. You get a foundation laid, you get a little bit built, you don't get it all built. So what's the consequences to the builder? He says, what are people going to do? They're going to laugh at him. They're going to mock him. They're going to say, this guy's a fool. Who was he to think he was going to build this building? He got it halfway up and quit. He says, they're going to make fun of him. Well, I would tell you, if that's the worst that would happen to us, is that people make fun of you, then the consequences aren't that severe. But Jesus is making a point by using these other references that he makes, including the carrying your own cross. And he said, so what's the point for us, for disciples? What is it that he's saying to you in this passage? Talking about counting the cost, and the builder counting the cost, and if not, you get a foundation laid and some building built, but you don't get it completed. What's that mean to you? What's that? You're not going to make it to heaven? Yeah, I mean, he's going to talk about even having to die for him. Ken?
I think part of it is he wants people to fully understand what they're getting into before they start. And sometimes I think we sugarcoat it maybe a little bit. Yeah. But people still today need to understand what it means to follow Christ.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you didn't hear that, he's saying, we may have a tendency sometimes, especially in this today and in this culture, to sugarcoat it a little bit, not getting people to understand what all is involved. We live in a time where, at least as far as televangelism and that kind of thing goes on, there's an entire health and wealth gospel that will make you feel like, you know what, everything about life is going to be automatically be better if you choose to follow Christ. You know, and Christ is saying, I'm telling you, may not work that way. It may be tough. Your family may turn their back on you. You know, I'm telling you, there aren't many people on television who are preaching who are saying, come to Christ. You know what? You may lose your whole family over this. They may all turn their back on you. They may all hate you because of this, making this choice. That very, very difficult decision, you know, to make. Or telling you, you know what? Come to Christ. You may have to quit your job in order to come to Christ. And all of a sudden, you know, it's a whole different mentality. Whatever the case is, you may have to give up your life for the cause of Christ. He's saying people have to know on the front end what they're committing to. We learn more about what that means as we go. Would you agree with that? But what does he need absolutely from the beginning? He needs the commitment 100%. We've talked about that before. We use that in a lot of different marriages. When I sit down with a couple that I am counseling premaritally before they're going to get married, that's one of the things that we talk about. That there are things you're going to learn about marriage somewhere down the road. There's no question about that. I can't even share it all with you because I haven't learned it all to share it with you, and because people's experiences are different. So there are things you're going to learn as you go. But what they need to understand, and I want every couple to understand, is you need to the day you say I will or I do, you need to understand you are committing for a lifetime to one person. And so we have a whole lesson that deals with the covenant nature of a marriage relationship. Do I understand what I'm getting into? And Jesus is saying the same thing. We are in an agreement, covenant agreement. He's made promises to us, but he expects certain things from us in return. And he says, you have to do all that I ask. And people need to know that. Okay?
He's talking about the cross. He's not saying carrying a sack of flour. He's talking about something that implements pain and suffering.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't get any image. It isn't an issue of the burden of the weight. Though Jesus had been beaten so severely, he fell under the weight of carrying his cross. He's not talking about, I'm telling you, I'm going to put something on you that's a heavy weight. You're carrying something that in and of itself symbolizes pain and death. And you can't get away from that. So it is important. He's saying you, when you're coming into the picture, and I've told this group before, I delayed a fairly good while coming to Christ and being baptized into Christ when I was being taught, because there were aspects of my life that I understood intellectually, because Ralph was pulling no punches. He was saying, if you come to Christ, this has to fall by the wayside. I understood that. And it wasn't that I thought, you know what? I think you're wrong. I think that's okay. It was more a matter of me saying, I'm not willing to give that up yet. And so fortunately, he was also the kind of teacher who said, if you're not willing to give it up, then don't come. You know, you don't get many teachers. That's kind of the Joshua method of evangelism, isn't it? You know, Joshua said, as for me and my house, and all the Israelites said what? We're right on board with you. And he said what? No, you're not. You can't do it. He said, you can't do it. That's the way Jesus is doing. He's saying, you can't be my disciple. He's not saying, I'm not going to allow you. He's saying, I need you to understand what that means. That's what Joshua was trying to get the Israelites to understand. Coming to Christ is an absolute, total, lifetime commitment. And so he goes from that into a second comparison. He talks about a king. Why the difference in the parable? What do you get out of that that's any different for you? Because he says there's a king, and he's going to go to war. And he's sitting down, he's reviewing his army, and he's saying, I've got 10,000 soldiers. And I know the guy that I'm about to go up in war against has 20,000. And so I've got to evaluate, with my 10,000, can I take his 20,000? So he's trying to make some evaluations. And he says, if not, what are the choices? What are his choices? Suppose he says, I can take that 20,000 with my 10,000. What do you think his choice is going to be? I'm going to war. We'll fight. What if he says, I got problems. That army is way bigger than I thought they were. His 20,000 will run over my 10,000. So what's he going to do? He's going to go home. So what's the point of that for us? I mean, that's kind of an odd analogy in the sense of he's saying, if you don't have enough money, don't start the project to begin with. So now what's he saying?
Are you ready to die?
You ready to die? Do you have the wherewithal? You ready to give whatever it takes and not? It's still in a matter of evaluating choices, is it not? It's a matter of saying, what exactly am I getting myself into before I make the decision? So have you ever thought about talking to somebody about Christ and talking about those kinds of things? The kinds of consequences where you would say, look, I think it's very important that you need to understand. Either you're willing to commit 100% to the Lord, or you're better off just going home. Don't start. I mean, do you not think that's a tough thing to say to somebody you're trying to reach with the gospel? I mean, Jesus' goal was to do what for these people? Send them packing? Wasn't his goal. It was to save them. But he used words that were going to send some of them packing, didn't he? That's tough. Have you ever had that? How many people in here have ever had a conversation across the table from somebody you're trying to teach that you've had to say, you need to be willing to commit completely or you're better off just not committing at all? You ever had that conversation? That's a tough conversation to have, but it's one we need to be willing to have. Don't be afraid to let people know that they have to commit to the Lord the way that the Lord said that they have to commit. So that's the first idea, as I'm thinking about reaching out to somebody else. But the second part of that has to be turned inward, doesn't it? Am I continually ready to give up anything in my life that gets in the way of my Lord? Because you think that stops once you come to Him? Because I made that commitment back in the 70s. Made the commitment to come to the Lord. And at that time, made the commitment that I was 100% committed, that I was going to come. You think in the last 40-some years, there hasn't been an opportunity to have to recommit that concept because there are choices you have to make that you understand there may be some things getting in the way? What does it take to commit? Mark? Yeah, sometimes it's not addressed. It doesn't mean that I wasn't determined I wanted to be saved and have my sins forgiven and was being baptized for the purpose of having my sins forgiven. But I may have known very little about commitment. Yeah, Ken, and then I'll make another comment. Well, no, I was just going to say, I don't know, how many people in here have ever heard of or read, F. Ligard Smith's got a book called Baptism, The Believer's Wedding Ceremony. Very interesting book. I'd encourage you to read it because he talks about, it is so important. He says, we would never dream in the terms of thinking about two people getting married that had no understanding of what was being asked of them. He said, so we need to be careful because he says baptism is the believer's wedding ceremony in that sense. Understanding that I am giving my life to the Lord and making that commitment to the Lord. So he talks about, so you look at infant baptism. He says the whole concept of infant baptism equates to a shotgun wedding. And I thought that's a good reference. He talks about that, you know, somebody else is calling the shots. Somebody else is marrying me or an arranged marriage. That somebody's marrying me to somebody else without my involvement in that at all. And he says, we do need to have that level of commitment and understand. Yeah, Ken?
I think there might be an element in this third piece here. He's talked about, you know, carrying your cross. He's talked about counting the cost if you're building something. But on this third one, he starts up and says, if you're a king, you get an army of 10,000. Back in those days, an army of 10,000 would have been a pretty good force. Okay, so you're somebody. What you're really up against is somebody who's got a minimum of twice what you got. Not only do we have to count the cost of what we're going to personally have to give up, we need to count the cost of what if we don't choose to follow Christ. I think there may be a little of that in there to play too. It says, yeah, you better figure out how you're going to sue for terms of peace because one way or the other, this is going to affect you.
Yeah. And I think that's a good point because it's how am I going to accomplish the personal victory in this? And it's going to have to be on Christ's side. Whether in the king's instance, like Ken is saying, whether it means I've got to go make peace with somebody or I'm going to fight against them. Am I considering all the equation? Because the consequence of the and the concept of war is lose. You win, you lose. He says, I've got to make sure I am on the winning team. In that sense. And so very interesting as, you know, as he makes the point for us as well. Look after that, though, in verse 34. I mean, just here's one of those times where he's got all of this teaching that he just had on counting the cost. And we know in chapter 15, where we'll go next, he starts talking about the parable of the lost sheep, the coin, and the son. But now he says, salt is good. But if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is of no use either for the soil or for the manure pile. It is thrown away. He who has ears, let him hear. What's the point of the salt? What is he saying here? Yeah, all right, it can, and it has a purpose. No question. Salt has a specific purpose, does it not? And you know, those that cook would say it's to enhance flavor. But it has a specific purpose. So he says, so what happens when salt doesn't taste salty? Why would you even put it in? It's not going to accomplish anything at all, is it? So he says, it's possible. So what's the point for us? Because he's been talking about counting the cost and all the things that go with that. And then he says, salt's good, you know, as long as it's salty. He says, but then when it loses it, doesn't serve any purpose at all. He says, it's not even good to put on the manure pile to help with decomposition or anything else. When it's lost its saltiness, it's basically just a rock then, isn't it? So what is it, you know, what is it that he's trying to get you to understand here?
You need to be salty Christian.
We certainly need to be. He tells us in other places like Matthew, of course, now I grew up in a time when somebody said that, and that's a salty guy over there. That was never a compliment. So we need to be careful as to what kind of salty Christians we want to be. But we do need to serve that purpose. In Matthew, he tells us specifically, we are the salt of the earth. We're intended to accomplish that. Other comments? Why do you think? Go ahead, Ken. Or go ahead, Mark, and then Ken. Interesting as far as the what is he expecting from me regarding duration and serving him, Ken?
Yeah, basically, I was going to say it's one of these where you count the cost and whatnot, but if you don't choose right, you're basically worthless.
Yeah, if you don't, I mean, God has a purpose for us, but if we don't make the right choice, he says, what good are we at all? What purpose do we serve at all? He says, we're like the salt that's lost its saltiness. Larry, are you raising your hand or just?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry. I've been ignoring you for 5 minutes because I couldn't tell if you were raising your hand or just had a twitch.
I know. He is telling me to make a commitment. You know, this has always been a scary one for me because it's like it's been, salt can't be recycled. I buy a lot of refurbished things. You don't buy refurbished salt. When salt is done, it's done. And that's just a scary thing to think about. We're supposed to be salt.
Yeah, great point. And that's, Jesus makes it clear. Once it's lost its saltiness, what purpose does it serve? To me, it'd be like having a soft water chestnut. What's the point? It's only there for the crunch. If it's not going to crunch, may as well leave it out of the recipe. Wait, say it again. Yes, turned into a pillar of salt. It means that you ought not look back, but other than that, I can't tell you what it means. Yeah. No.
I think we can infer she didn't count the cost.
Yes, she didn't count the cost very well, that's for sure. But, I think he does want us to understand. There's some serious choices to be made, and that seems to be what he's indicating throughout all this. He turns around and blasts them with a couple of statements to begin with, and then tells some stories to make the point of the statements. And he's saying, you know what? Don't take lightly your commitment to Christ. Understand what it is that you have agreed to do. And there are times in our life where we're not forced to consider that the same way that others may be forced to consider that. Would you agree with that? I'm 64. To date, there has never been a threat that somebody was going to come in and arrest me and cut my head off because I served Christ. I'm not saying it can't happen. The way this country's headed, who knows what will happen in a generation's time, but that's never really been a great threat. But we know there are other people that have not only live under that kind of threat now, there are others who have lost their lives that way, are there not, for serving Christ. And he's saying, understand, it's pretty serious. In Revelation chapter 2 and verse 10, when he says, be faithful unto death, the idea is not... We always tag that on like that's the sixth step of salvation. We need to hear, believe, repent, confess, be baptized, and be faithful unto death. In other words, until you leave this life. But that's not what he means in Revelation. Revelation, he's saying, when they're ready to lop your head off, don't quit the Lord. He's not talking about 80 years from now when you die of old age. Not though that would be the case as well. Endure, but you better be ready in case you have to face death as well. Yeah, Josh? And that's tough because, like Mark said, it's very difficult to get any young child to truly grasp a lifetime of commitment because it's difficult for them to even have a concept of that many years in advance. And so it has to be based on helping them to understand that there are going to be a lot of times, what we did at least with the boys was trying to get them to understand, there are going to be a lot of times that people and this world is going to try and get you to do the things that you shouldn't do, and you have to make a decision now whether or not that's the path you want to follow or not, because it's not going to be easy. And trying to get them to understand, advanced decision is what gives you the strength to overcome, and trying to get them to grasp that. I would tell you there's a good booklet put out too, though, that by Mark Roberts, that is called Am I Ready to Be Baptized? That parents are to go through with children. That's a good, very good little book. The parents take the first sheet or two, and they fill it out, and then they tear it out, and then the child goes through the book after that, and it forces them to ask some questions about that. So, yeah, Ken?
I think it's also the case that emphasizing, you said, the commitment, but then as the children grow and are still under, one of the things we have to focus sometimes is that baptism isn't an adulthood ritual. And sometimes when younger people still have the heart to make that commitment, they're still going to need guidance. And so as they continue to grow, you continue to encourage them, you continue to remind them that they made the commitment, and, you know, reinforce that.
Yeah, and that's a great point. I would tell you the reminder of the commitment is critical. Peter says in one place, he says, you've got myopia, you're nearsighted, because you've forgotten. You've forgotten when you were baptized. You forgot what that really meant. You know, it wasn't just the forgiveness of your sins. It was a commitment of a lifetime to Christ. So it is that continual reminder of the commitment that we have made. Good point. And then finally, I just thought, you know, think about the responses to Jesus' teaching. You know, we talked about all last year, this whole concept. They left everything. They just dropped the nets. They left everything and followed Jesus. That was the response of some people. You read in Matthew, in Luke chapter 5, after this, Jesus went out, saw a tax collector by the name of Levi sitting in a tax booth. Follow me, Jesus said to him. And Levi got up, left everything, and followed him. I mean, there were incredible commitments made to Jesus during the time that Jesus was walking on this earth. But then you come across others like Mark chapter 10, and it says Jesus looked at him and loved him. One thing you lack, he said, go sell everything you have and give to the poor. You will have treasure in heaven, then come follow me. At this, the man's face fell and he went away sad because he had great wealth. That's the whole point of the parables, is it not? Jesus is going to say there's something that may be between you and total commitment to God. Whatever it is. For this man, money. For other people, whatever it may be. He says, you're going to have to be willing to give it up. Joe?
Well, some followed him because they thought he was going to be the future king, earthly king. And so they had some selfish motivation there. And that went by the wayside when they put sacrifice.
Yeah, great point. And some lessons they didn't learn until he was gone, and then they learned them very quickly. But yet we find out what? Incredible commitment, because even as they were learning those tough lessons, did they stand true to their Lord, even to the loss of their own life. All right, good comments. We'll pick up on lesson 9 next time.